Riverhead Books and Read It Forward present Marlon and Jake Read Dead People, a podcast with Marlon James and Jake Morrissey.
I'm very excited to talk about dead people because I love speaking ill of the dead.
It was the worst of times. It was the worst of times.
You know what? I'm not going to defend that book.
Enough about you. Let's talk about what I think.
They're Jane Austen characters. I love that everybody's like, why?
Not a fan of The Hobbits.
I'm about to walk out of this room right now.
If you're going to be that obvious, why don't you just hit me with a 2x4 and be done?
That is some serious shit. Welcome to another episode of Marlon and Jake Read Dead People with me, Marlon James, and my editor, Jake Morrissey.
Which would be me.
You know, I'm supposed to, like, do a better intro for you.
You know what? I think I'm okay. Good editing is invisible, so I think I'm all right.
Oh, God, you know. Editor to some, butcher to others. Anyway.
Potato, potato.
So in this episode, as we always do, we'll be talking about dead authors, which is me saying we'll be fighting over dead authors and the books they wrote, telling you what we think about them, why I'm pretty much always right, and why Jake is usually always wrong. He's wrong about live authors too, but that's another podcast. So get ready for some book talk that you won't find anywhere else. So even though you did it already, you can continue introducing yourself.
I am Jake Morrissey, and I am the man who keeps Marlon James honest.
I thought Jesus did that.
Wait, that's another podcast. Come on, pay attention. Pay attention. We're going to do this right here. But we want to talk about what today?
So, I mean, in this episode, we're going to talk about books, of course, by dead authors, but books that have been made into movies and movies that have been made from books. And this has been happening since for more than a century ago. Some of the silent films are actually based on books. People right. just didn't read and didn't realize they're based on books. So we're going to talk about good movies that were made from good books, bad movies made from bad books, good movies made from bad books. And sometimes bad movies made from good books, which is most of them.
You have very high standards.
You know what? I'm just trying to keep Hollywood honest. So, Jake, what do you think makes a good adaptation from a book?
Okay, as an editor, I think it's important that you have to understand the story you're telling, whether you're a novelist or a filmmaker. I also think you have to understand the format you're telling the story in. A movie obviously is visual. It conjures its story up with pictures and words. And a book obviously is a silent conversation or dialogue between an author and a reader. So I do think a novel and a movie are similar in that they're both the medium of one person. In the case of obviously a novel, it's the author. In a case of a movie, it's the director. And they're the ones who sort of – they're at the helm. They're the people who are sort of guiding what the story is, how the story's told, who the characters are, and what they do and why.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would add that there are some differences. I think, for example, you can tell when a movie is merely just a film book.
All right. How can you tell that?
When I think it may be too faithful to the text, when it's okay. Depending too much on things that I think a book can get away with, like abstraction, like endless parts, you know, scenes of thought, you know, epiphany in a book. Not everybody has an epiphany, but an epiphany usually is a very private
yes.
thing.
Yes.
And it's very hard to sort of translate that in film. At the same time, I think films, the really good ones, can have a sense of economy that I wish more novelists would learn. You know, in my creative writing class, I have them watch as many films as they read books because there are things that I think films do well. Like I would say to my students, you know, a sunset doesn't need your help.
All right. Are there films that or movies that you tell your students you should watch for this particular talent or quality it has?
Yeah. Like, for example, I have a class on evil. Because it's actually wow. hard for people to write villains.
Wow.
And hard to break it down. And I always have them watch.
You must be one fun professor. That's all I can say.
I'm a barrel of laughs. So one of the films I have them watch or scenes I have them watch is a scene in The Manchurian Candidate.
Which is it the end?
Not the end. Not near the end where I can't remember what Angela Lansbury's character is, but it's when under hypnosis she tells her son that, yes, she was behind this diabolical yes. plan. and
she's the bad guy.
She's so sad that she didn't know they're going to pick her own son.
Right.
And the cool thing about that is that nearly everybody else would have ruined it by trying to redeem her. Instead, she leaves the scene even worse than she entered it.
You hate her as more after than you did before.
It's not even that you hate her. You understand her.
Well, you understand the hate. You understand why she hates so much.
Yeah. You know, we talk about in my class sympathy versus empathy because I'm not a big fan of empathy. But
to no one's surprise.
Sympathy in the original meaning just means understanding between us. And that's the thing that Angela Lansbury's character does in that scene is, no, I'm not trying to redeem myself. Right. I just want you to understand me. Right. And if you think you've seen anything yet, when I off my husband, then I become president. But yes, it can do that in books as well. But I do think there's a simplicity and an economy in film that sometimes books don't capture.
All right. Well, then talk about a good what you think is a good book that became a good movie.
A good book that's also a good movie. Actually, we can talk about something pretty recent, Little Women.
Okay. Which version of Little Women?
Actually, the Greta Gerwig one, which I really, really like.
All right. Why do you like it so much?
I like it so much because I think I was surprised that so many of the modern touches, such as, playing around with the timeline, works so well. Because I think that It brought out facets of the character that I think can get schematic.
So the fact that the way the story was told or how the story kind of evolved to the viewer was different from the experience that the reader had. You were okay with that?
Yeah, I was absolutely okay with that because I think we're not lacking good, faithful adaptations of Little Women.
Well, we're certainly lacking a lot of good adaptations, period. I mean, in my opinion, the Katharine Hepburn version that George Cukor did back in the 30s was terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And the June Allison, yes, June Allison, who is the only person that I remember as, a bad singer, had her own version. And I actually even like the Winona Ryder, Susan Sarandon version.
I really like that one. One of the things that...
But all of those were very straightforward telling of the story.
This wasn't straightforward, but it wasn't pretentious either. It wasn't this sort of, let me just show you how, all that I learned from, watching French French New Wave or Italian Neorealism.
So even if you weren't a French Neorealist, you didn't necessarily think, oh, this is a weird telling of the story.
No, it's not weird because it's almost as if it realizes these sort of parallels in a different timelines, which also sounds kind of pretentious. But it sort of, for one thing, it had a great way of actually underscoring heartbreak, which I thought was really interesting.
The heartbreak of Joe?
Yeah. And also the heartbreak of Beth.
Right.
That when you realize, this movie sort of pivots between two instances of illness with Beth.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
It kind of frames itself around that. Like, Bette survived the first one, didn't survive the second. Spoiler alert. So it's the way to bring a sort of a new lens to an old story and doing it very well. My problem with a lot of just about almost every attempt to bring a story into the present, particularly when people mess with Shakespeare, is
oh,
it feeling
that bothers
to improve?
You.
Oh yeah, stop trying to improve it. It's like when people try to improve Macbeth. Just stop.
Don't do it anymore. All right. Well, when you mentioned that, one of the things that occurred to me when you were talking about it was I'm old enough to remember the first movie version of that great mystery, Murder on the Orient Express, with Albert Finney and Lauren Bacall and Ingrid Bergman and Michael York, all these sort of famous stars from the 20th century, which was a very, very linear, specific telling of the mystery, and it was incredibly satisfying and I think successful. The new version with Kenneth Branagh screwed, in my opinion, some of the details of the story. It tried to make it more dramatic. Yeah, and I'm like, why?
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that if you do it right, if you're Greta Gerwig and know how to do it right, it's as satisfying an experience as reading a good novel. And I'm saying maybe that, what's his name, Kenneth Branagh, maybe needed to spend a little less time on the cutting room floor and a little more time listening to the text.
Yeah. And she even restored some text. Not restored, it's in the book, but almost nearly every adaptation of Little Women, they cut out where the mom says, I'm angry almost every day of my life.
Right, right.
Yep. And they brought that back, and it was like it was a kind of a chills moment.
Right. Well, the thing I'm speaking as a somebody who read Little Women and appreciated it, but it didn't speak to me on a visceral level. My problem with it is that Jo didn't need a guy at the end. She mm-hmm. didn't need she needed she and it was clearly Louise May Alcott never married. She never had, as far as anybody knows, any significant relationship with a man. It needed to be somebody. I wanted that to be different.
Mm-hmm. I don't think Alcott would have done that.
No, of course
definitely not.
Of course.
I mean, that's like saying Austin would have done it.
Well, true. All right. I want to talk about a more recent novel, which is The Exorcist by William Peter Blatty.
I never read the book.
Okay. It came out in 1971. I read it as a kid and I reread it as a grown up. For my money, it's the most shocking novel and most shocking movie I've ever seen. It's the story of a 12-year-old girl whose mother is an actress who's over the course of she gets sicker and sicker and sicker, and it becomes clear that it's not just something medical. Mm-hmm. And so the mother calls in two priests to perform an exorcism on her daughter. And I'm not going to give anything away, unlike you, blabbermouth that you are.
You know what?
I'm going to say—
If you haven't seen it yet—
I'm going to say that evil is very much part of this whole novel and film from beginning to end. And it remains the most disturbing movie I've ever read about faith. Mm-hmm. And it was the first horror movie ever nominated for Best Picture in 1973. Mm-hmm. It was nominated for 10 Academy Awards. It won two, one for its screenplay and one for sound mixing, which if you know anything about what happens in The Exorcist, you know that they worked really hard to get the sound right. Anyway, it's creepy, it's disturbing, it's incredibly well done, and the novel is, I mean, in the end, I had the same experience reading the novel as I did watching the movie. Now, interesting to me at any rate is that the author of the novel wrote the screenplay. Mm. How important do you think that is? Does it matter?
Sometimes. I think when a vision is particularly singular, I haven't read the book, but I've seen the film, you'd want the author.
Right.
Sometimes the author gets in the way.
Right.
I don't know anything about Blatty. That's his name, William Peter
Blatty. William Peter Blatty is the author of the book, yes.
But I wouldn't be surprised if his cultural vocabulary was pretty wide.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are things that can be resonant in a novel that just don't translate in a film. And there are things in novels, there are aspects of novels that can just be reduced to abstraction.
Right.
That just doesn't work. Because, yeah, sometimes actually the last person you want to write the screenplay of a book is the author.
Because they're too close to it.
They're too close to it. And one, they're going to write a very long script. Because it's, there's a part of me, I'm here writing scripts and I'm like, but if I could do this in 60 pages, why did I write a 700-page novel?
There are millions of people around the country asking exactly that same question. But I mean, as you have done both, you've written mm-hmm. obviously novels and screenplays. Do you as a writer, do you approach them differently? Do you think?
And adapting is also very different.
Well, when do you decide, okay, I can get rid of this in my own work?
Can you
be ruthless on your own stuff?
I can be ruthless. No, I wasn't ruthless. I wouldn't have been as ruthless like 4 years ago.
Okay.
But I can be ruthless now, and I can cut something and not think, well, if I cut it here, why didn't I cut it there?
Right.
Kind of thing. If anything, I'm not too ruthless.
This is music to my ears. I got to tell you,
that's my film.
That's
muscle.
Your film, right? Exactly.
Yeah, that's not going to adapt. You're still getting the 800-page novels. I don't know where you think you're going.
Looking forward to it. Well, all right. What do you think? What do you think was a great novel that was turned into a terrible movie?
Where do we start? God. I feel like doing more than one and just speaking quickly about all three.
All right. An embarrassment of riches. We want this.
Good book, horrible film, Angela's Ashes.
Okay. Explain why the movie's so bad.
No, Angela's Ashes is interesting.
Explain what Angela's Ashes is.
It's Frank McCourt, a wonderful, wonderful Irish writer, wrote a memoir of his absolutely horrible but occasionally hilarious childhood.
It sounds completely counterintuitive that it would be so hilarious and so moving and so horrible and so readable all at the same time.
Yeah, but, you know, McCourt understands that tragedy and slapstick are right beside each other.
Yes, but there was a lot of bad stuff that he
There's
had
to a lot do. Of – it was – yeah, it's you'd think it was unfilmable, except McCourt is such a cinematic writer.
It's very visual. Yes, very true.
It's very visual. So he's like, it's almost cliff notes for the screenplay. It's like, this is what you do. This is what you don't do. And Angela's Ashes is, and there are quite a few films like it. This phenomenon, what I call the well-made bad movie.
Ooh, I like that. I like that.
The production value is great. It's all moody and nice. The fog rolled in exactly you wanted it to roll in. The actors even try, and the movie stinks.
Okay.
And you can tell this. It's I don't know if they were too timid with the material. I don't think they were. I just don't think anybody was. I think this happens sometimes when all the imaginative work is done by the book.
Totally. Totally.
The filmmaker adds nothing to it.
Yes. Well, that was my experience. The great novel that, in my view, that was turned into a terrible movie is Philip Roth's American Pastoral.
I didn't even know that was a movie.
I know. I know. It's like me and three other people saw it, I think. It's the story of a former high school athlete in Newark, New Jersey, who grows up and has this kind of upwardly mobile kind of middle class life and sort of basically he's kind of destroyed by the political and social upheavals of the 60s, even though the novel itself was written in the 90s. Anyway, if you haven't read it, you should read it immediately because it's brilliant. If you haven't seen the movie, never spend 90 minutes seeing it. It was with Ewan McGregor.
Is he starring in it or just
directing it? He's starring in it and directing. It's his directorial debut. And God bless him, he tried.
Well, there's only one.
It's terrible.
The thing is, Ewan McGregor is a fantastic, wonderful actor. Probably not a great director.
I mean, the thing about Ewan McGregor is I never saw Trainspotting.
Whoa.
I know.
I think we need a moment.
This seminal
film in my life.
And I found
talk about movie and books that are both good, but
okay.
Irvin is still alive, so we can't talk
exactly
about it.
Now. Right, exactly. We need to. I have other views on Ewan McGregor movies based on books that I will move on to. But anyway, I do think for me, something like Beloved. Which is an American masterpiece. Toni Morrison's novel is an American masterpiece. Mm-hmm. The movie, I gotta say, I don't know if it necessarily needed to be made into a movie because I think there are some novels where you have a conversation, a dialogue so profound and so deep and so resonant and satisfying with the reader that I don't know if it necessarily needs to be in a different medium or a different format. And that was my experience with the movie version of Beloved. I'm not here to say anybody was good or bad in it because I think an argument could be made on both sides. It felt to me unnecessary, really unnecessary, because in my view, there are certain novels, I think The Great Gatsby is like that, where it's actually the only way to actually experience it is in the form of the novel.
Gatsby is interesting because there have now been three adaptations and they're all bad.
Well, I got to say the Baz Luhrmann one made me yearn for the one with Robert Redford and Mia Farrow.
See, there's a reviewer, and I can't remember her name, but she has a really good way of reframing films. And she said the thing about if you want to watch the new Gatsby, this is how you watch it. The new the Baz Luhrmann Great Gatsby is Gatsby had Gatsby made it. And the second I read that, I'm like, this is no fascinating. It's still atrocious.
Right. It's appalling. Yes.
But it's fascinating viewing it that way.
Well, okay, I get you're right. I mean, the idea of the thing I always approached Gatsby is this is a novel about hope. This is Gatsby had hope and he had money. Myrtle Wilson had hope and she had no money, and their both lives were destroyed. And that's a concept, that's an idea that I think needs to live within you, not seen splashed across the screen in
flapper dresses.
Exactly. And you know, bad jazz music. Mm-hmm. I think it's for me, it's all about the way in which the story is told, and I got to tell you, Toni Morrison, I'd rather read it from her. Mm-hmm. I'd rather read it from Fitzgerald.
Mm-hmm. Very, very quickly, two other movies that I think nowhere near as good as the books. The Killer Inside Me, I think, is interesting because people keep trying to make that film, and they keep failing at it. The Jim Thompson novel, The Killer Inside Me. People keep trying to make it, and they keep failing at it.
Why isn't it a success?
Because if you're gonna do The Killer Inside Me, you have to come to a whole new idea about evil. We were just talking about evil before,
right?
And it's I always wonder if it would be better if it was made by a French filmmaker. That it's ultimately too dark and non-redemptive for a Hollywood studio or a Hollywood film or a Hollywood actor. Nobody's going to go into I talk about Heart of Darkness. Nobody's ever going to go that pitch black.
So that deep. Okay. All right. Well, what about does it matter? Does it matter that it's made by a man or a woman?
I wonder. I don't know. Because The Grifters, on the other hand, is fantastic.
The one with
Angelica Houston.
Yes, that's right.
And yeah, so and that's a good film, good book.
Yes.
This is just a passing shot of horrible films, of good books. The Hobbit. Why
did
this happen?
I am so glad you said that, because I know your
three of them.
Yes, your enthusiasm for Tolkien is well known.
Yes,
I stand aside in your enthusiasm, but The Hobbit is, first of all, it's as a novel. What is it? 450 pages? 500 pages? It's 700 pages too long.
The Hobbit is not that
The Hobbit
long.
Is not you know worth what? Reading. Spoiler alert.
Oh God!
Anyway, it doesn't. It's a prequel to nothing.
Don't think that because he's an editor, he's actually a smart listener.
Anyway, I found it unendurable.
Where is your childhood?
Well, that's the thing. I don't actually think it's something that a kid needs to read.
Oh, I thought you were going to say I didn't actually have a childhood.
I sprung fully formed from the forehead of Zeus, ladies and gentlemen.
I think I don't know. I think The Hobbit, especially if you read it at the right age, maybe that's 9 or younger.
All right.
Is just this wide world of possibility that you had to commit to. And I think, I'm trying to think of other books. It's a kind of book when you realize that you're maybe too old for Narnia.
Okay, it's the book for me when you realize that you're not interested in places with round doors and people with hairy toes.
Hobbitist.
I'm anti-Hobbit. There's going to be pitchforks thrown at me as I walk out the building tonight.
Can a bad book be turned into a good movie?
What do you think?
I think it happens all the time.
I agree.
I think I'm wondering if you're going to talk about the one I'm going to talk about.
Well, you talk first.
Well, a bad book that made a good movie, Jaws.
Okay.
Bad book that made a good movie, Jaws.
I actually think it's a better book than you think it is.
Really?
Because it had no pretense that it was supposed to be anything but entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
But
so is the film.
Well, that's my point, though. Why do you think the book isn't as good as the movie?
I don't think the book... How do I put this? The thing that I think made Jaws so interesting is that Jaws ultimately is a horror film.
Absolutely.
I don't know if I got it from the book.
Well, because it wasn't a horror film in the book.
But I prefer the horror element.
Well, my point is that it was a story of a chase.
Mm-hmm.
People were running after this great white shark to try to kill it.
Mm-hmm.
And in the movie, which was, I think, if you read the stories about the production of it, was supposed to be a huge failure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had this mechanical shark look ridiculous. It was like, you know,
It was terrifying.
Well, that's the thing, is that all the pieces together made it this amazing, scary movie. I remember seeing it on the coast of Maine on the 4th of July, the year it came out, thinking, I'm never going to the ocean again. Mm-hmm. And I had read the novel. So it was, I think, for something like that, I think it was a very effective adventure story on the page, and it turned into an incredibly exciting movie, even though I knew the end. Okay, it's not like it was a surprise.
Okay, fine. It's not a bad book, but the movie's better.
Okay, why do you think the movie's better?
Almost with what you just said a while ago, I would have read the book and gone to the beach.
All right.
After the movie, you couldn't get me. Not even in fake sand.
No way. Says the man from Jamaica, ladies and gentlemen. Okay. All right. All right. Well, I do think something like a bad movie from a good book.
Can I just say the good movie from a bad book?
The good movie from a bad book. All right. I think a good movie from a bad book. Oh, The Godfather.
See, I knew you were going to say that, so I left it for you.
You're such a giver. Mm-hmm. All right. I reread The Godfather about 5 years ago. And, you know, I'm a middle class editor, and it is a mess editorially. On the other hand,
What is the opposite of a middle class editor?
In other words, I'm not in eighth grade.
Oh, okay.
When I read it for the first time.
Or I'm going to go, hold on, I can get me an upper class editor. As you were.
None of this. I want more pretense in my editors. But the thing was, I when I read it at, 14 or 15 years old, it wasn't – I mean, the fact that it's lying in pieces in front of me as a reader didn't bother me. I think it's an incredibly effective movie about the mob.
It's a fantastic film. It's a perfect film.
Yes, yes. And he made it an even better one the second time he tried to tell the story.
Yeah.
And I think it's a credit to actually the understanding with the story you want to tell. And I would argue, I think in the case of the movie version of The Godfather, it's about the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true also, I think, for the novel, because the novel is such a mess, you can't even tell what the story is.
Mm-hmm.
The story taken apart and put into screenplay to make it sense.
Yeah. I never read The Godfather. I read The Sicilian. I think it was Mario Puzo's book in the 80s. And I remember thinking, wow, Godfather came from this kind of prose? Because he was a journalist and he was a good one.
Yes, yes.
But yeah, I just knew you were going to say The Godfather, so I gave that.
You are very nice.
I gave that to you.
Thank you.
I think of other movies that are better than the book, Princess Bride. It's not a bad novel.
No.
But the film is just a classic.
All right. I have daughters who love The Princess Bride. It's not something I'm going to spend 5 seconds worrying about. Why do you like it so much?
Why do I like it so much? I think it's, I don't know.
Why do you like the novel so much then?
I didn't like the novel that much. I thought the film had charm. And I think charm is a very elusive quality that you can have to a film.
I agree. That's actually a very good point. Not a bad book can't have charm or doesn't have charm. A movie from a bad book can.
Yeah. Especially if the person realizes that this book is lacking in charm. So we better,
put some charm in it. All right. Good. Good.
Mm-hmm. So coming up next is a part of the podcast we call Dead People, Places, and Things. And these are aspects of the books or authors we've talked about that strike us as interesting or unusual that we might have specialized knowledge about. Basically, the part that Jake likes to talk about.
I love this part.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to go first then. Mm-hmm. I edited Ellen Burstyn's memoir, Lessons in Becoming Myself, and her book, which is terrific, by the way, and well worth reading. And in it, she writes about her experience filming The Exorcist. Now, for those of you who don't know who Ellen Burstyn is, she is an incredibly talented actress whose career has spanned 40 years and has been in everything from Requiem for a Dream to The Last Picture Show. And the stories that she tells about filming The Exorcist are astonishing. The whole process took 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And a security guard for the set was shot and killed. The son of the actor who played one of the priests in the movie was hit by a motorcycle out of nowhere and was in intensive care. One weekend when nobody was in the building where the filming was to take place, one of the sets burst into flame and had to be rebuilt. And it got to the point where the director, William Friedkin, began having each set blessed by one of the Catholic priests who'd been hired as consultants. So this is a story about evil that people actually, even when they were making the story about evil, had to defend themselves against.
Wow. And Aerith, I'm trying to think of, because in my, you know, one of the things you may not know about me is that I was an exorcist in a past life.
You were an exorcist, or you were exorcised? Right. I know that you were that you went through an exorcism.
No, I was also an exorcist.
I had no idea.
Oh yeah, except in evangelical church we call them deliverers.
Well, I got to say the Catholics do it much better than anybody else.
Well, that's because Catholic demons are just nasty.
They are. They are nasty.
Evangelical demons are just annoying.
I'm so proud to say that I am come from a faith where the demons are really nasty.
Yeah, I have no time for Catholic demons. I'm like, you can have her.
No time for Catholic demons. Coming soon to bookstores everywhere. The Marlon James story.
Exorcist.
Well, what do you have to talk about for dead people, places, and things?
It's funny. I've always been interested. This is not a book. This is a play, actually, which I think the stage and the film were both great. Streetcar Named Desire.
Okay, which you like them both?
I like them both, although I have one caveat. I have one objection, rather.
Which is?
Because Marlon Brando played Stanley Kowalski. Yes. And fun fact people didn't know is that Brando had his jeans specially made.
In order to?
So that they're super tight and show off his man junk.
Wow.
Because Brandon knew what everybody knew. He was the prettiest thing in this film.
Now, okay, this is for the movie or is this for the play?
For both the play and the film.
Okay.
Because he knew it. He was the prettiest thing in the film and he knew it.
Okay, do you know, complete theater trivia, do you know who was the original Blanche DuBois?
No.
In the play? Jessica Tandy.
Oh, I did know that. I did know that. So I got into a fight with my literature teacher because we're doing Streetcar Named Desire and he's trying to argue about Stanley being an anti-hero. In the realm of like the main character in Look Back in Anger, whose name I forget because I hate that play. But anyway, and he just kept going on and on and on. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He's as deluded as Blanche.
Yeah.
He talks about all these friends he doesn't have and he's going to have these important people. I'm like, dude, you're a loser. You have no important friends. You're a deluded rapist.
Wow.
And he kept going on. And I went, it's because, look, you and I both know it's because you just want to sleep with Marlon Brando. That didn't go well.
No, I'll bet that affected your final grade. I'm just saying. I'm just guessing.
I don't think I had a final grade in that class.
Okay.
I don't think. It was either me or him, and I think I left. I don't remember.
Well, the thing about I think Tennessee Williams is a great American playwright. The thing about that I'm always interested in from his plays is I'm always interested in, like, the kind of secondary male characters.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Streetcar, it's the Carl Malden character.
Right.
In the case of Glass Menagerie, it's Tom.
Mm-hmm.
And the Gentleman Caller and those sorts of things.
Yeah, yeah.
They're kind of the morality of the stories that mm-hmm. Tennessee Williams tells. And yet, in the end, Tennessee Williams just saying, we're all just mm-hmm. circulating in a godless universe eternally by ourselves.
But speaking about morality, the other thing about Streetcar Named Desire, which I think is interesting, is that half of the acclaim, in fact, 90% of the acclaim, or not the acclaim, the kind of, put it this way, I don't think people realize how much of Stanley Kowalski's reputation rests on Marlon Brando being pretty. Because my argument with him was that had you given Carl Malden...
Yes.
Marlon Brando's
role. If Ernest Borgnine had been...
When we were talking about anti-hero, we talk about who's that disgusting, vile, deluded rapist?
Right.
Screaming for the wife he's about to abuse.
Right.
Like, come on.
Right. That's fair. That's, you know, pretty people in this world get along much better than the rest of us do.
See, I always say he who's prettiest makes the rules. But that tends to only apply to high school.
Well, I would hope until good sense sets in.
And I can't speak as an authoritative high school because that would make me creepy. So we've finally come to the segment we call I Don't Give Two Shakes of a Rat Ass What You Think. This is where each of us makes a case, persuasive or otherwise. You can tell I did not write the script.
Oh,
persuasive
stop
or otherwise, for a book or author that we know the other probably won't agree with, but one they're willing to stand by. Jake.
All right. I'm going to make the case for a book I read as a kid called Babe the Gallant Pig and the movie version of it.
Can we take a moment to laugh?
Go ahead. Mock. Go ahead.
Hey, I love Big Pig in the City.
Well, one of the many caveats I have about movies is that I hate talking animals. I cannot listen to or watch Finding Nemo or mm-hmm. Bambi or
really?
Charlotte's Web for that
so
reason.
So you can't watch most of Pixar?
Most of, yes, exactly.
Wow.
Having said that, I make an exception for Babe, which is the story of how, you know, an orphan piglet gets himself adopted in this family, and this is in the book, in a farm in England, and with help from friends in the barnyard, manages to figure out how to become a sheep herding pig, and his farmer Hoggett enters him in a sheep herding competition, and where he wins, by showing good manners and being polite.
Mm-hmm.
It's a book about how sometimes I think the good guys win one, and despite it being full of talking animals, and mm-hmm. despite having humans that who have no idea that these animals are speaking to each other in English, you know, in their barnyard,
mm-hmm.
I found it a charming, kind of hopeful, positive book and movie. And my daughters liked it as much as I did when I read it to them when they were kids.
So this is when you're doing like Watership Down?
Okay, I'll make another exception for Watership Down because I like that one too. But I have to say, I've only read the book. I've never seen the movie.
Because I'd have so resigned you
no,
as
no,
my editor
no, no.
on it, live on air.
It's a great, great novel, but I don't have to listen to it. I don't have to listen to, you know, the bunnies chattering to each other in their burrows.
Okay, so mine.
All right.
This is the fight to begin all fights.
Uh-oh.
What I think is the absolute greatest film adaptation of a book ever
is
Die Hard. Y'all think I'm joking. So Die Hard is actually, most people don't know Die Hard is from a book.
Okay, I did not know that Die Hard
it's
was from
a book called Nothing Lasts Forever. It was written it was published in 1979. It was written by this writer, Roderick Thorpe, probably not his real name. And it's a sequel to a novel called The Detective. And of course, nobody knows this book.
Nobody knows this book.
In fact, after the film became famous, people still didn't know the
okay,
book.
Okay, now, how
usually you do a movie tie-in.
Totally. Now, how did you come across this? Have you read the book?
No. Yes, I did, actually. I did, but it was so forgettable that I immediately thought, no, I didn't read it, but I think, yeah, I did.
Did you read the book before you saw the movie?
No.
Okay.
Because I didn't know it was from a book.
Wow. All right.
And then, of course, I was super curious because
only
I'm going to see how it's going to be a book. But also, I used to read those type of books in the 70s. Books with characters named the Penetrator and the Executioner and the Destroyer. I read all of them. And the guys named like Mac Bolan and, you know, names that were super butch in the 70s. That's gay porn now. And yeah, Die Hard is based off Nothing Lasts Forever. And by those standards, it's the greatest film adaptation ever.
Because it does exactly what the novel does?
No.
All right. So how based on, how free is the adaptation?
It's pretty free. It's pretty loose.
I'll bet.
It's,
I'll bet.
Yeah. It's, you know, I mean, I could go on talking forever about the brilliance and genius of Die Hard, which I also think is the best Christmas movie ever made.
Okay, the best Christmas movie ever made is The Ref, despite it being having Kevin Spacey in it.
Yeah, we'll take a
Dennis Leary.
Pause. No, Die Hard is the best Christmas movie ever made. Anything that good set around Christmas makes it the best Christmas movie. If it's an Armageddon film, that's good. If Mad Max was set on Christmas Day, then it would become the best Christmas film.
Now, so the novel itself. Okay, so what happened? You saw the movie, love the movie.
Yeah, the thing about the movie's smart. That's the thing about it, which it's funny and it's also super super smart, and it's not afraid to laugh at itself.
Okay.
None of which is in.
I was going to say, does the novel do that?
No, because the novel is trying really really hard to be a good book. Unlike, what was the film, the book we were just at, Jaws, mm-hmm. which knows full well what it is.
Yes, yes.
I don't think this novel knows what it is. It's like when I read some detective fiction, no, I won't name them because they're all alive and we're not talking about living people.
We sure aren't, that's right.
And there were things like, it fell sort of like the stock market. It's like, no, that's what I expect from high school students.
Right, right. Sorry, that doesn't
That's
work.
A high school metaphor. It's like, it was sunny, like night is not. It's like that, no. So that's all we got for this episode. Thank you all for listening. We want to hear from you, so feel free to send us your feedback and ideas at wereaddeadpeople@prh.com. And if you enjoyed this episode, even if you didn't enjoy Jake, we hope you'll subscribe.
What's not to enjoy? Come on.
You're just a bundle of liars. He's an editor, so he's going to cut out all of this. Anyway, so if you've enjoyed this episode, we hope you'll subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And don't forget to rate this podcast, as it helps more people to discover my brilliance and Jake's habit of being wrong about everything. He's right about me being right, though. So you can follow Read It Forward and Riverhead Books on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for updates on all things books, all of them written by living authors in this case, of course. And we have links in the show notes to the books that we've talked about today. So thanks for listening. Now go read some dead people. You right. can read some living ones.
And Marlon James. Read Marlon James.
Who's very much alive.